Well, by my watch, it is 1:30 Eastern Standard Time. Welcome, everyone, to the first teleclass in the 2004 Weber Training Teleclass Series. A special welcome to you if this is your first teleclass experience. And greetings to the members of the Eastern Ontario Professionals in Infection Control who are using this teleclass as the educational part of their meeting today. Welcome all. My name is Paul Weber, and the topic today is relative impact of hand hygiene on healthcare-associated infections. My thanks to Deb Medical Hand Hygiene for their sponsorship of this teleclass. It sure helps to make it possible to bring these to you, and I want to thank them for their support of infection control education all over the world. Thank you, guys. You do good things. Teleclass education in 2004 will feature many fantastic topics by the most authoritative and eloquent experts in the world. And to start the year off properly, we have one of our favorite faculty members. I'm delighted to be able to welcome today's faculty, Dr. Elaine Larson. Dr. Larson gave a teleclass last year that has become one of the most accessed recordings on our website, and requests for free copies of the recording on CD have come in by the hundreds from healthcare professionals in developing countries. It's fair to say, I think that her research and teaching has had a very global impact. And this lady wears many hats. She is a professor at Columbia University, and many of you will know her as the editor of the American Journal of Infection Control. To give the teleclass relative impact of hand hygiene on healthcare-associated infections, it's my privilege to present Dr. Elaine Larson. Elaine.
Okay, thank you, Paul, and let me add my welcome to my colleagues out there. Many of you I know, and I hope that there's something new that we can discuss today. The talk today will probably be a little bit less than an hour, so I hope we'll have time at the end to find some way to also have some discussion. This talk actually came about because of an invitation last year from the Norwegian Nurses Association and Infectious Disease Society, who asked me to give a talk on, okay, we have the new hand hygiene guideline. What if everything gets perfect? What do we have left in terms of infection control? And I sort of turned it around a little bit. So what we're going to talk about today is not so much what we have left, but to the best of our understanding, which is actually kind of pitiful, but to the best of our understanding, I want to talk about the evidence of what impact hand hygiene can have on infection rates, healthcare-associated infection rates, if we did it perfectly according to the guideline. So now when I turn the slides. I'm sorry. Do you all turn them? How does this work?
If you would just indicate when you're changing slides, and everyone can then go on to the next slide.
Okay,
at the
thanks.
Same time.
The next slide. What I did was I looked at the literature, and here are the criteria for the review of studies. I did a literature search from 1960 to 2003. And I didn't look at outbreak investigations or retrospective studies, but what I wanted to do is see how much research there was that was prospective in nature, that occurred in an acute care setting, that was written in English, and that's just because of my limitation, in which the intervention was hand hygiene, and the outcome of the study was healthcare-associated infection rates. So it was a very specific set of criteria to look at, and they were intervention or experimental in design in general. So on the next slide, I've just summarized first some of the early work, and those of you, I know there are a lot of you on this conference who are more familiar even than I am with hand hygiene, but let me just review for all of us together some of the classic work that was done in the 1960s, which will never be repeated again. The reason primarily is because one could never do this. It wouldn't pass a human subjects board review anymore. Because in those days, this group of investigators did a series of studies in newborn nurseries. And at that time, in the 1960s, you may recall that there were pandemics going around the world of infections with Staph aureus. At that time, I was an infection control nurse, and I remember several times during that period having to close our nursery because babies were getting infected and babies were dying from Staph aureus. So, and during that time, we were actually being taught that Staph aureus was transmitted primarily through the air. I remember not only in the curriculum that we had, but also in a movie that I remember very well that was produced in an attempt to try to reduce infections, that showed Staph aureus being carried in yellow clouds on mops and through the air. This group of investigators was one of the first to demonstrate that Staph aureus, among, like most organisms, like most bacteria certainly, are most commonly transmitted not in the air, not on fomites, but on the hands of people. What they did is a series of experiments, and I'm just going to review a few. One of them, they had children, neonates, handled by a nurse who was a known staphylococcal carrier, had a certain phage type in her nose, and they had her touch the babies one time to admit the babies to the newborn nursery with unwashed hands or with washed hands. So the baby was touched only once by a nurse carrier of Staph aureus. And what you see on the slide is that when the neonates were handled by the nurse with unwashed hands, 92% of the time that baby acquired the same phage type of Staph aureus as was carried by the nurse. With one hand washing and no touching again throughout the entire stay by the colonized nurse, that rate of transmission was reduced to 53%. So one hand wash in these newborns that you can consider sort of a virgin territory or a clean slate because they're just newborn, it halved the transmission rate, almost halved it, just one hand wash. So that was actually a reduction of about a third. Now in the next, that I would actually advise any of you who are interested in this topic to look up those studies. I've given you a couple of the references there. They did a number of different studies like that. They had another study where they had nurses who were carriers sit next to a baby with a standard amount of distance, like 12 inches or whatever, and read out loud to the baby. And they had the same carrier handle the baby's clothing and so forth, or pick up the baby. And what they found is that babies did not acquire the staph colonizing the nurse unless the nurse actually touched and picked up the baby. So that was some of the early evidence that the primary mode of transmission for many, many kinds of bacterial infections and viral infections, but this was just Staph aureus, is in fact with direct contact, not through the air, not through sneezing necessarily, although it can happen, not with touching the bedclothes. The next slide summarizes a couple of the other early studies in adult intensive care units. Mark Casewell in 1977 published one of the early studies showing that with an intervention of hand hygiene, hand washing, Klebsiella infections were reduced. This was a very weak study in terms of the study design. It was almost anecdotal. But that's the way a lot of the early studies are. And that, in fact, is how we often discover things, primarily just from our own clinical observations. And then if we sort of develop a hunch or a hypothesis, then we go on to do some more solid kinds of testing. Dennis Mackey in 82 published another study. And in 84, Massoneri and Herrholzer published studies. These were the two early intervention studies that looked at the effect of hand washing and different types of soap on infections. Again, they had some design problems. We always have some design problems, but they were consistent, both of them, in showing that you can reduce infections with hand washing interventions. The next slide talks about a combined intervention that combined hand washing and cohorting of neonates to try to prevent the transmission of respiratory syncytial virus in hospitalized children with congenital heart disease. As you know, respiratory syncytial virus was and still continues to be one of the sort of last bastions of problems in pediatric units, particularly with sick children, because they are highly prone to getting very, very ill from respiratory syncytial virus. And what they found with this two-pronged intervention was that they were able to reduce the transmission of RSV in the hospital from 34% to about 3% in over two epidemic seasons. Again, there's always a problem with time series like this, but this was another intervention that showed consistent results. The next slide summarizes four other studies that were done in intensive care units during the 1990s. Brian Simmons and his group in 1990 attempted to have a hand washing campaign in an ICU and reported that there was no impact of the hand washing campaign on infection rates. And in fact, a number of studies that have just tried sort of educational or putting up posters or whatever kinds of campaigns haven't shown any impact. But it's very hard in these studies to sort out how much of it is because people, after the first week or so, actually don't continue to do the intervention, or how much of it was that the soap actually didn't work or that hand washing actually didn't work. In 92, Brad Debeling published a landmark study, and again, for those of you interested in this topic, you'll probably already know about this study, but for those of you who want to sort of get your files filled with the kinds of sort of classic studies in this area, this is one that you should get. It was published in the New England Journal. It was, I believe, in a number of intensive care units in Iowa. I can't remember if it was five or seven, but anyway, it involved thousands of patients. And they compared in this study chlorhexidine containing soap for hand washing versus an alcohol rinse with plain soap. And this was, as you know, 10 years before the CDC guideline recommending alcohol came out. What they found was that the periods in which the staff were using the chlorhexidine soap actually had significantly lower infection rates than the periods when they were using plain soap and alcohol hand rinse. Now, I talked to Brad about this study, and it's also discussed in an editorial that was written by Don Goldman and I in the New England Journal. And what this says is probably not that chlorhexidine gluconate was better than alcohol, because what they also showed is that during the alcohol and plain soap regimen, staff were significantly less likely to use the alcohol. So really what they ended up testing was the difference between an antimicrobial soap, chlorhexidine gluconate, and plain soap with an occasional use of alcohol. At that time, alcohols were considered to be drying. They were not well accepted by staff. But the important thing to me about this study is that it did show that in the same ICU with different hand hygiene products, you can demonstrate significant differences in infection rates, which means that that hand hygiene probably does have an impact on infection rates. The next studies, the two in 94 and 95, were also studies that demonstrated that MRSA was eliminated with a hand hygiene intervention. However, both of these studies had other interventions going on at the same time. And that's a problem with a lot of the research and the studies on any intervention that you're looking at. But in this case, with hand hygiene, usually, when you're doing an intervention, you're doing more than one. So that is a big problem with sort of tried to interpret and sort out which ones of these interventions really worked. I did want to mention on the next slide a descriptive case control study that was published in Infection Control and Hospital Epidemiology in 95 by a group from Brazil. They had an outbreak in Brazil, and this all breaks my criteria for my chart review or my literature review, because this was an outbreak investigation, but it was a case control study. And it was in surgery, and they looked at a variety of risk factors using the case control design. They looked at whether those who were infected were in different operating rooms, had different staff, had different antibiotics. They looked at multiple factors. And the only significant correlate that demonstrated an important increase in infection rates was when the OR had run out of antiseptic hand scrubbing product. So during those times, they had to use plain non-antimicrobial soap instead of a traditional surgical scrub. So they concluded from this that the antiseptic hand scrub was probably having a protective effect and was reducing the risk of surgical site infection. Now I want to talk on the next couple of slides about a hospital-wide intervention that we undertook a couple of years ago. And the next slide talks about the intervention in the comparison hospitals. Now, you may have heard of this study before, and there are a lot of limitations to this study, which we can discuss later if you'd like. But what we wanted to do in this study was to see if we could have a hospital-wide impact on hand-washing behavior and subsequently on infection rates in two different hospitals. We did this study in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area in 1998 over a period of 8 months. As you can see, what we did to observe, we didn't want to stand there and observe hand washing in the whole hospital because, first of all, it would have been prohibitively expensive, but also we would have suffered from changing people's behavior by knowing if they knew that they were being observed. But what we did is, with some support from a corporate sponsor, we were able to insert into a number of soap dispensers automatic counters so that each time the soap dispenser was pushed, the counter made a click. Now, of course, obviously, some people, if they make, you know, three or four pushes on the lever, that we still counted those as three or four washes rather than one, but we assumed that problem it was the same in both hospitals. We had one intervention hospital and one comparison hospital. We tried as much as we could to match two hospitals that were similar in terms of types of ICUs, infection rates, risks, staff in the hospital, staffing rates, and using the NIST definitions and using the same surveillance techniques for looking at infection rates. So these were just the numbers of hand washes that were recorded during our study period. Our intervention, we had one hospital that was the intervention hospital and the other that was a control hospital. Our intervention was really based on a theory of trying to change organizational culture rather than trying to work on a single unit and looking at an individual nurse or physician as our sort of client. We were looking at the entire hospital. So instead of starting from the bottom up, that is from a unit up, we started from the top down with the hospital board of directors. So in the intervention hospital, we first met with the board of directors. We gave a presentation telling them about the, you know, importance of hand hygiene. We talked about the costs of infections, and we tried to estimate as closely as we could how much money we thought we could save in reducing infections if everybody in the hospital wash their hands as according to the CDC guideline. And we asked them if they would be willing to be the hospital that was known for hand washing and that we would have a organization-wide intervention. So they bought into it. Then we met with the medical board, with the chief nursing officer, and we talked with them about the same thing, and we asked them to give us a list of the 20 most important thought leaders in the hospital. And we didn't care whether they were staff positions, line positions. We didn't care whether they were head nurses, attending physicians, orderlies, whatever. But we wanted to have the people who were most likely to be influential in affecting other people's thinking and behavior. So they gave us a list of 20. We formed a couple of focus groups with those influential people, and we talked to them about what they thought would work in their clinical setting for improving hand hygiene behavior. Now, when I looked at the interventions they planned, I was pretty discouraged, because what they told us they thought would work was exactly what we've been doing for years. Put up posters as incentives, put little notices in their paychecks about how important this was, have them demonstrate their competence, give them feedback. These things we'd been doing for years, and we'd found that they really didn't work to change hand hygiene. But when we went ahead and did the study, and much to our surprise, we think it did work. And I think the only reason that it worked this time is because it wasn't an intervention that was imposed upon this hospital by the outside. It was something that the thought leaders bought into because it was their idea. So to me, that I think is what really worked in this study. Now, in the next slide that says mean hand washes per patient care day, what I want to show you here, the study hospital where the intervention took place is in the lighter color, and the control hospital is in the darker blue. And our thought with this was that if we were going to make a change in the culture of the organization with regard to hand hygiene, it would take some months, that we wouldn't see a big jump for some time, but that over months we would hope to see a gradual rise in the hand hygiene. What you can see is that in the follow-up period, which was about 8 months after the intervention, we did see a big rise in the hand hygiene frequency in the study hospital. We also saw some rise in the control hospital. As I mentioned, the soap dispensers had the counters on them in both hospitals. So both hospitals knew they were in a study. They knew it was about hand hygiene, and they knew that we were observing or keeping track of their behavior. Now, we did not have these counters in every single ward. We picked the intensive care units and I believe the newborn nursery as sort of marker units for the whole hospital. So both hospitals had the same level of attention in terms of knowing that they were in a study. So really the only difference between the two was the actual intervention in the intervention hospital. Now, the real question for this talk is, did this intervention make any difference in infection rates? So let's go on to the next slide. In the intervention hospital, we observed about 110,000 patient days, and these are just the numbers of infections that we had. The two infections that we monitored, again, because neither hospital did surveillance of all hospital infections, so we didn't change the infection control department's surveillance strategies. They used the same definitions, the same surveillance, but they were only looking at multi-resistant bugs, vancomycin-resistant enterococci and methicillin-resistant staph. So those are the two organisms that we used as our markers. And in the comparison hospital, we observed about 237 patient days. The next slide looks at the methicillin-resistant staph aureus rates per 1,000 patient days in the two hospitals. What you can see, now, first of all, notice by the p-values that this change over time was not statistically significant from baseline in the first column to intervention period to follow-up. What you can see also, however, is that in the control hospital, the rates rose slowly over this period of time. In the intervention hospital, the rates decreased. Again, that could have occurred by chance because it's not statistically significant, but the trend is in the right direction. For VRE, in the next slide, we did see that there was a significant reduction in VRE rates in the study hospital over the intervention time into the follow-up period. What you see is that the rate continued to go down. In the control hospital, during the intervention phase, which was not going on in the control hospital, there actually was an outbreak of VRE, which is why the rates went up so high there. But there was a statistically significant difference between the two hospitals in VRE. The next slide, additionally, when we looked at changes from baseline to the follow-up periods for MRSA, in the intervention hospital, there was a 33% decrease in MRSA. In the comparison or control hospital, there was a 31% increase. This difference was highly statistically significant, despite the fact that the actual numbers or rates of infections were not different. The decrease and the increase were significantly different. And finally, in the next slide, in the intervention hospital, there was an 85% decrease in VRE at the time between the baseline and intervention. And in the control hospital, there was a 44% decrease, but there was still a significantly greater decrease with the intervention hospital. So again, that's indirect, but some promising evidence that the hand hygiene campaign or intervention that was done in the intervention hospital did have a measurable effect on the nosocomial infection rates. The next slide summarizes a couple of other studies done during the decade of the 2000s. First one by Dr. Patay, and all of you are familiar with his work if you know the area of hand hygiene. He actually has studied over a decade, actually longer than a decade, the effect of hand hygiene interventions in his very large hospital in Geneva, Switzerland. And in 2000 in Lancet, he published a paper that was done in the medical and neonatal intensive care units demonstrating that with increased hand hygiene and with a hand hygiene intervention, there was a reduction in VRE. Again, there was no change in MRSA. It's actually interesting to think about the epidemiology of these various organisms, and perhaps, clearly, there are some organisms that are much more likely to be amenable to barrier precautions and control mechanisms such as hand hygiene than other organisms. And VRE, which we know is a bug that also survives quite well in the environment, may be one that lends itself much better to control with hand hygiene than some other organisms. And then a second study in 2001 was a hospital-wide intervention, and it reported a reduction in intravenous complications after hand disinfection, but not after regular hand washing with a non-antimicrobial product. Another study just published last year in an orthopedic surgical unit, this is in the next slide, showed that over a 10-month period, infection rates were reduced by about a third after the introduction of an alcohol-based hand rinse. And in the next slide, this is a study that was done in a long-term care facility. They collected infection data in the facility for 34 months and demonstrated, again, about a third decrease in infection rates on the two units that were using an alcohol hand sanitizer as compared to their usual product. On the next slide is a summary of data from a randomized clinical trial. And again, this is not just a hand washing intervention. It also included gown and glove isolation, as well as strict hand washing in children with solid organ transplants. And what they found is that this both interventions, actually they compared the two, I'm sorry, they didn't do them together, they compared the two interventions. Both of them resulted in significant reduction in infections. And so that's sort of another indication. Now this next study on the next slide is another classic that I would recommend that you have in your file if you're interested in this area. It is a study published in 2002 in the Journal of the American Medical Association, and it's the first clinical trial that has looked at the effect of several pre-op hand preparation protocols for the surgical staff and their effect on post-operative surgical site infection rates. This is a study that was done in France with clean and clean contaminated surgery, and they followed patients for 30 days after surgery. They used several protocols. One was a 75% propanol. Another, this is for the regular surgical hand prep. The second was a 4% povidone iodine, and the third was a 4% chlorhexidine gluconate. And what they found, as you can see, is essentially identical surgical site infection rates in whatever, regardless of what the surgical hand prep product was. Now, the reason this is important is because you want to make sure, now that the CDC has recommended alcohols for hand hygiene, that we're not increasing infection rates. And it's actually quite reassuring to know that with this number of subjects, a little under 5,000, the rates are almost identical. There may have been some difference in rates that couldn't have been identified because they needed a larger sample size. But this is a pretty good sample size. And what was even more important, I think, is that when the alcohol products were being used, the compliance with the hand hygiene protocol was significantly better, and the hands were less dry with less skin irritation. So if, in fact, rates are the same with these two products, but compliance is better and hands are healthier, then that argues in favor of using the product that increases or improves the hand hygiene behavior. In the next slide, the next few slides, I just wanted to talk a little bit because I know a lot of you are in industry and many of you are working as clinicians in the hospital, and I don't know a lot about health impact assessments, but it seems to me that a very promising way of looking at the effectiveness of some of the interventions that we do, hand hygiene being a very good example, is to do a health impact assessment. And health impact assessments, as you know, are used to recommendations are made from these to improve practice. It's a practical way to influence decision makers, and people use these assessments to assess policies, programs, and projects. So I think that those of us who are in healthcare need to pick up on this kind of an assessment to look at hand hygiene, both in terms of its effectiveness and efficacy in the hospital setting and also for the general public. One component on the next slide of a health impact assessment is to identify and consider the range of evidence for potential impacts on health and equity. Now, the first step in that is what I've tried to do with the review of literature, and I know that I haven't hit everything. I have certainly missed some literature, but it's essential to collect and collate the best available evidence and then to consider the evidence and appraise its impact. So with regard to hand hygiene, on the next slide, what evidence is available? Well, there's plenty of evidence from developing countries and in daycare centers and other community settings that hand hygiene does reduce the risk of infection. But these studies may or may not be applicable to hospitals or to long-term care facilities. And I just reviewed for you what we do have in hospitals and long-term care facilities in terms of data, we can't really study this issue in hospitals in the same way that we might outside the hospital for ethical reasons, because we can't have placebo groups and we can't have groups where we tell the provider not to wash their hands. That's why I think mathematical modeling and health assessments are a promising approach to look at efficacy. Quantitative assessment of risk reduction from hand washing with antibacterial soap after exposure to enteric pathogens was the name of a study. It's on the next page. And what I want to do now is just show you some studies that have actually used these kinds of modeling techniques to estimate what hand hygiene efficacy might be. What they concluded in this study is that adequate washing of hands after diapering reduces the risk and can be further reduced by a factor of 20% by the use of antimicrobial soap. Again, those of you who are into modeling and have some expertise in this, I urge you to look at these studies. I'm not doing a lot of critique and critical analysis of the quality of the data in these studies, although I didn't put them in if I thought they were, unless I thought that there was something of benefit for us to look at. The next slide reviews some mathematical models for transmission dynamics. And in this very interesting article, the authors simulated the use of three control measures in the hospital. Those three were effective hand washing, an antimicrobial policy to limit the use of antimicrobial agents, and curtailing the admission of colonized patients. In this modeling study, what they concluded was that effective hand washing compliance reduced staff colonization, but had only a limited effect on patient colonization unless colonized admissions were also curtailed. So that was the conclusion from that modeling exercise. On the next slide, again, this was some modeling that was done to look at how to control VRE in an intensive care unit. And what they found, or what they concluded, was that the impact of infection control was to reduce the prevalence of VRE from a predicted 79% to an observed 36%. And they concluded that the most powerful measures of control were the hand washing and the staff cohorting. And we'll read the quote together. Compliance for hand washing significantly in excess of reported levels or cohorting of nursing staff are needed to prevent nosocomial transmission of VRE in endemic settings. The next slide summarizes, again, a stochastic model for Staph aureus spread in a med-surg ward. They modeled the introduction rate, prevalence, and colonized patient days, and they concluded that small increases in the frequency of effective hand washing would be sufficient to control endemic organisms. Next slide. In all these models, however, there is a caveat that's very important that I know you already appreciate, and that is that slight changes in any of the assumptions or the parameters in these models have a major impact on the findings, and that unpredictable or chance events, such as outbreaks, are amongst the most important factors in determining the course of an outbreak. So while these models, I think, can be helpful, and they may be for a lot of things that we're trying to assess, the only way we can really safely do these assessments, we have to be very sensitive to the limitations of such modeling. So let me summarize now the results from the modeling and from the studies. The studies are not entirely consistent, but in general, the Isaac study found about a 90% reduction in respiratory syncytial virus with hand washing and cohorting. The Austin model calculated that there would be about a 50% reduction in VRE transmission and hand washing with hand washing and cohorting. In our study that was published in Behavioral Medicine, we found a 30% reduction in VRE and MRSA with the hand washing intervention at the hospital level. And then a couple of other recent studies have shown about a third reduction in infection rates when alcohol hand sanitizers were introduced. Now, of course, you know that it may be the alcohol product itself that had made a difference, or it could simply be the introduction of something new that caused people to attend more frequently to their hand hygiene. But for the purposes of looking at the effectiveness of hand hygiene, either reason is still important. If you can, in fact, reduce infections by increasing frequency of hand hygiene and or changing product, both of those are important things to know. Hence, what I would conclude is that results from these clinical studies and from the mathematical modeling are fairly consistent, that there is potentially approximately one-third reduction in infections with ideal or at least improved hand hygiene from what we have now. And as you know, right now, we don't have particularly good compliance or behavior in terms of hand hygiene. So let's go on to the next slide. What if hand hygiene were perfect? From a study that we did recently to look at the attributable costs of various types of nosocomial infections, you can see that from a review literature that we did, the costs per infection range from somewhere between $13,000 and $38,000 per infection. So if we can reduce infection rates by even a few a year, it certainly pays for the amount of soap or hand hygiene product that one might use in a year in any given hospital. Now we're getting into some speculation here, but on the next slide, if in fact about 30% of healthcare associated infections are preventable, and that piece of information comes from the old study of the efficacy of nosocomial infection control, which was, as you know, published by CDC in the 1970s and 1980s. But if in fact 30% are preventable, and there may be evidence that even more now are preventable than they were 20 years ago, and if we accept the premise that I've just proposed to you, that hand hygiene reduces the risk of infection by about 30%, then, if I'm doing the math right, and you can correct me if I'm not, about 9% of current infections could be prevented by hand hygiene alone. And that, although it doesn't sound like a lot, it actually is a lot of infections in terms of both cost and numbers. So in summary on the last slide, there's still much to do and there are many options to try. The two main areas of focus that I think we need to do in infection control is, from the patient side, we need to do what we can to improve host defenses. By we, I mean all of us, basic sciences, immunology, genetics, everything that comes together to make people healthier when they come into the hospital and more able to resist infection. So that's one avenue of work. The other avenue is that we need to look at other practices and products that make it easier to prevent infections and to reduce them. But even with what we know now, with a 9% reduction in infections just with hand hygiene, it would be a major patient safety coup. So with that, we'll end, and it looks to me like we have a few minutes left for some discussion.
We do indeed. Thank you very much, Dr. Larson. That was another fantastic presentation. I particularly liked your comment early on that your hand hygiene campaign in the intervention hospital succeeded only when you enrolled the thought leaders in the hospital. And that was excellent. And again, they're not always doctors, are they? They could be from any discipline.
Oh, yeah. In fact, most of them weren't physicians. They were people from various departments, housekeeping, et cetera. But they were clearly known by the leaders to be thought leaders in the hospital, which says a lot about leadership. It's actually very interesting. The other thing I forgot to mention is that in that study, we did the intervention for about six months. But the data that I showed you for the follow-up period was actually after the intervention was finished. In other words, it had already been sort of incorporated into the culture and was sort of going on without any additional expense or any effort on our part. Because our belief, after trying all kinds of other things, was that what you have to change behavior, is culture and attitude. You can't, it's motivation that matters. It's not really just facts, just knowledge.
And the question has always arisen, is hand hygiene, improved hand hygiene, sustainable after all the posters and things come down? And you're saying that in your experience with this hospital anyway, it has been possible.
Yeah, right.
Good. The phones should be now off of mute. If you have a question, please do identify yourself and ask your question.
Hi, Paul. It's Jim Gauthier calling from Kingston, Ontario.
Yes, Jim.
I'm actually sitting here with the Eastern Ontario Professionals in Infection Control. There's about 30 of us in the room here.
Great. Hi, guys.
It was a great presentation. I was wondering if you might comment on the combination of alcohols being put through a facility and keeping the antibacterial soap around. I've always felt that we should lean towards moving to a gentler lotion soap and supplement it with the alcohol instead of keeping the antibacterial around. I was wondering if you've seen anything or have any comment on that.
Yeah, you know, that's one of the big challenges now across the country. People are trying to decide what to do about that. This is my bias. This is not, based on any research. But it seems to me that if we are going to be using fast-acting alcohol-based products, and they are faster and certainly equivalent to an antibacterial soap or an antimicrobial soap, that we don't need both. But the CDC guideline, as you know, equivocates on that and gives you the choice. And I think that that's based not on so much on data as it is because there are some people who are not going to be able to tolerate the alcohols. It's not common, but we have seen some adverse reactions to alcohols, and there are adverse reactions to almost every product ever imagined. So some people, I guess, are thinking that for those who can't use the alcohol products, they will provide them with an alternative antimicrobial soap. I think that's the rationale in some places. If people can tolerate the alcohol, I don't see any reason why you have to have both.
Thank you.
I'm interested in the significance that you feel with the staff cohorting. Do you think it's a case of not introducing new people to a culture that you've sort of gotten some staff used to, or exactly what is the significance of the staff cohorting?
Okay, well, the cohorting actually usually occurs, as you know, when there's an outbreak. So let's say that you have a newborn nursery and there's an outbreak of methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, and there are some babies who are clinically ill, they're infected, some babies who are colonized but they're not infected, and then there are some nurses who are carriers. So the idea of cohorting is to put all the nurses and the babies who are colonized or infected together so that you don't mix those with the ones who are not colonized or infected. So that's kind of what is going on. This is kind of related, and I hope after we talk about it, it'll seem relevant. But we have just finished a study. It's not published yet, but it's been accepted in Infection Control and Hospital Epidemiology, so it'll be coming out in the next year, looking at what happens to the hand flora of new nurses who come into a new unit and whether it changes. And what we found, we had a neonatal ICU with 9 new nurses. Not only were they new to the unit, but they were new nurses. In other words, fairly new graduates. So they were, let's say, virgin nurses. And then we compared their hand flora with a group of nurses, experienced nurses, who had worked on the same unit for at least 10 years. What we found was that the new nurses, when they came into the unit, all had different strains of staphylococci, coagulase negative staph epi, and none of them were antibiotic resistant. Within 2 months of working on that unit, they had all acquired antibiotic methicillin-resistant strains of coagulase negative staph on their hands, and they changed their flora. So what this tells me is that the hospital and the healthcare environment is not only a risk to patients, but it also results in changes in the flora of the people who work there. And so I think the more you can not necessarily cohort, but keep your own organisms to yourself with proper hand hygiene and gloving and all that stuff, the less likely we are to share among ourselves the various organisms that ultimately we will become reservoirs of this antibiotic resistance that can then be transmitted to patients. That's a long answer, and it's not just related to cohorting, but my point is that there's clear evidence that we do share flora when we exchange with each other. And so during an outbreak, cohorting is very effective in keeping the flora from passing on to others.
Dr. Larson, I believe you've also recently completed a study studying the difference between antimicrobial and regular hand soaps. Is that right?
Yes, that's in the community. And I'll be glad to share some of the results with you, although you need to keep in mind that the antibacterial products that we tested in the community were very low levels of antimicrobial and not at all comparable to the kinds of antibacterial soaps that we use in the hospital. But what we did find is we studied the microbial flora of a little over 200 homemakers in Manhattan, and we randomly assigned them to either antibacterial products for cleaning and for personal hygiene and hand washing, or similar products without antibacterial ingredients. It was a blinded study, which means that the products were packaged without labels so that neither the investigators nor the participants knew whether they were getting antibacterial products or not. And what we found is that after a year of using their products, there was absolutely no difference. Excuse me, no difference in the antimicrobial count. I mean, the microbial counts on the hands of the population. But let me also hesitate to say, the antibacterial soap that we used didn't make a difference. But all of the homemakers had significant reductions in their microbial counts on their hands. So that what that tells me is that they washed their hands a lot more because they knew they were in a study of hand washing. And washing their hands with anything significantly reduced their counts. It's published in a journal called the Journal of Community Health. I believe it was in April of 2003. But it's Journal of Community Health, and the first author is Elaine Larson, so you can find it.
Sometimes when surgeons make their rounds, they do so with a retinue of residents, medical students, and nurses. If they don't wash their hands, the retinue and the patient themselves are reluctant to chastise the surgeon in so doing, because it places them in a conflict of interest. Would you
Absolutely.
Please address this?
Yes, that's true. I mean, there are some people who recommend that we have patients ask their providers if they've washed their hands or performed hand hygiene. I have a little problem with that because I think it does place the care provider and the patient in an adversarial relationship, and it's just too difficult for the patient in the dependent position to, have the nerve to do that. I mean, I've tried it myself, and I don't have the nerve to do it. So So, but I think that we do need ombudspersons for the patients, and perhaps the patients, well, certainly need to say something to somebody about that. It's very difficult in a retinue of, you know, like on rounds, to have everybody line up at a sink and wash their hands, but that's precisely where the alcohol products come in handy, because you don't have to line up at a sink. You can just put a squirt on your hands and let it dry while you're walking down the hall. So one option is to talk to the sort of the leaders on the unit, and if there aren't alcohol products available, that would be a recommendation that I would make.
I would like to say thank you, and we'll bring this to a close shortly. Thank you very much for those questions, and thanks again, Dr. Larson, for this very useful information. Those of you who join teleclasses regularly will know that your teleclass registration fees help to make it possible to share all of this information for free with healthcare workers in developing countries. And also making that program possible are our remarkable sponsors. And again, I'd like to thank Deb Medical Hand Hygiene for their sponsorship today. Until we talk again, thank you all for joining me. Thank you, Dr. Larson, for an excellent presentation. Stay safe, everyone, and wash your hands. Goodbye.